This is Backstory, the show that looks at the present through the lens of the past. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Ballow, catering to all your 20th century needs. We're talking today about the thing Americans for many generations have loved to hate, and that's taxation. As we do with each of our episodes, we've been inviting your input on today's topic at backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited a few of the people who left comments there to join us on the phone.
Next up, we have Beau calling in from Los Angeles. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
We're talking about taxation, a painful subject.
Yes,
share definitely. Your pain.
Thanks. Well, when I think about taxation in early America, there's the British tax on tea, and
yeah.
then later on America's early tax on whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And I know neither of those are very popular at the time.
Right.
The whiskey tax might be seen as quite different, since it was not simply a good source of revenue, but
mm-hmm.
a tax on a so-called sinful commodity.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about these taxes on vice, that they can be seen with a very different kind of scrutiny, that on one hand, taxing a sin might be seen as recouping a perceived cost to society, either an economic cost or a moral cost.
That's the way we think about it now, exactly. That's
yeah.
not necessarily the way they think about it in the 18th century, but go on.
Well, yeah, but I'm thinking that as opposed to paying back a cost, you could
yeah.
also perceive this as government's telling us what to do, and the tax is basically like a fine on bad behavior.
So what you're asking is, has tax policy served larger social purposes from the beginning of American national history and before?
Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to make one point about sin taxes and the whiskey rebellion. And it's important that Alexander Hamilton, the Secretary of Treasury, when he conjured up this excise on whiskey, was not thinking about the behavior of those Westerners. He was thinking about establishing a crucial precedent of direct internal taxation in the case that there was a war and we wouldn't be able to rely on import taxes. You had to have some other sources, and to establish and make normal and acceptable the imposition of excises was for him key to national defense.
But you know, Beau, what happens in the 20th century is the government, and now this is lots of levels of the government, not only uses taxes to collect revenue, they use taxes to achieve what people start calling policy
mm-hmm,
objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And there's much more policy. There's much more state. So they give people tax breaks in order to get people to build homes. And they do begin to use tax policies to stamp out sins. But here's what's really interesting. Even though taxes like taxes on alcohol in the 20th century and taxes on cigarettes start out as good faith effort to get people to do the right things, guess what happens
yeah.
when governments get used to those revenue
start
sources?
Promoting sin.
They become very dependent
yeah.
on this revenue, and policymakers get very worried about people drinking less or smoking less or driving less, to talk about the greenhouse effect, because gasoline taxes are going to plummet in the case of driving less. So there's some really interesting, unexpected, unintended consequences in the 20th, 21st century from attempting to influence behavior through tax policy.
Hey, Beau, we could think about state lotteries as a revenue source, right?
Yeah,
it's not exactly
kind of
a tax. What do you think about lotteries? I mean, how does it affect your
I always thought of, yeah, I saw lotteries as basically a tax on ignorance of math.
Beau, what would you change? What sin would you tax in order to achieve
any sin
some
that I don't
social
commit.
Right. So what would that be?
I don't smoke, so you can tax cigarettes all you want, I guess.
I'm sorry, someone beat you to that.
Yeah.
What about something that isn't taxed now that should be? My personal favorite is people who wear heavy perfume in elevators.
Yeah, I don't want to make too
I think
many
we should just throw the tax law at them, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Thanks for calling, Beau.
Thank you so very much.
We've got another call. It's from Brenda out in Des Moines, Iowa. Brenda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about an idea that I heard the last President Bush give, I think, in more than one occasion.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that the taxpayers' money is the taxpayers,
mm-hmm.
which sounds great superficially.
Right.
And then you end up with nobody wanting to contribute to things like infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to pay taxes, and then all of a sudden they gripe about the potholes in the streets, or to the worst extreme, like that bridge that fell down in Minneapolis.
So, Brenda, what is interesting to you is what we might call a kind of collective false consciousness, if not unconsciousness. Government gives a lot, and it can do that because of its tax powers, but we think it's ours, and we want to be able to pass on everything the government does.
Yeah, sort of the idea that because it's there in my lifetime, it's always been there.
Yeah, yeah. It's naturalized, you might say. It's something we take for granted.
Brenda, I think that in the 20th century, taxes like, you know, gasoline taxes have been very successful. Because people can see what they're getting. And what they're getting, by the way, are roads and infrastructure, as you talked about.
But it's not going to go for trains.
No, and in fact, it gets in trouble when Congress begins tapping into the Highway Trust Fund and these gasoline taxes to pay for urban mass transportation. People say, hey, they're not driving, you know, they're not using our highways, they're not paying gas taxes. How come we're giving money to build subway systems?
Yeah. So in a way, you could say that interest groups or groups that understand themselves to have a common interest then become key players in tax policy.
And they try to set aside those taxes. And of course, the granddaddy of them all is the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right.
The notion that we are contributing to our own funds for our personal retirement, that money is set aside. And that is the key to why Social Security is such a popular program. The notion that we're getting back what we put in for us individually, which of course totally defeats the general concept of taxation, which is that it needs to go for the collective good. I think, you know, people like to know what they're getting. And I'm just making a very simple point that when government does so much, it becomes much harder to know what you're getting for your
taxes. Well, it becomes like G.K. Chesterton's Invisible Man.
That's
right. Which is actually a whodunit about a murder that's committed and other crimes that are committed and things and like, you know, there is nobody here. Well, yes, there was, because the culprit was a mailman, and he just sort of disappeared into the woodwork. And it's like government itself has become like that. You know, we just assume that our food's going to be safe because it's been inspected, and we don't think that we have to pay for it.
No, and you're back to your point about taking it for granted. I understand that. But here's another thing that happened in the 20th century. That's lots of governments. Right? You used to get taxed by your local government. You used to pay property tax. You had a sense of where those are. Now we have the income tax. We have the federal government taxing you. We have all kinds of special taxing districts. And I think it becomes very hard for people to know not only what is their tax money going for, but to even keep track of all the places that it's going. So, Ed, tell me that back in the 19th century, it was much simpler and people just loved paying taxes, right?
In the 19th century, Brian, it was much simpler and people really loved paying taxes. You know, it goes to the point that taxation was much more concrete. It actually makes your point very well. Working on the road was a kind of taxation. And
you literally worked on the road, right?
You did. Yeah. Or you had, you know, you paid poor guys to do it. And ironically, that's continued through the Civil War. You could pay people to fight for you.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it's very concrete. If you think about the example of the taxes that Americans have paid most willingly, even happily, they are for the one thing that the state can do that they could not do otherwise, which is wage war.
Yeah.
And if you think about the sacrifices that Americans have made,
great point.
They tend to be, you know, from rationing stamps and all these different kinds of things, they gladly do it if they say, I can see exactly where it's going, it's to defend our freedom. But as soon as it gets less concrete than that, then doubts start to arise. Even the road, well, why don't we just do a toll road?
Exactly.
Then, right? And so if it can be privatized, I think because Americans believe that business and profit is a kind of accountability that government does not have. I remember my dad always had a phrase when we were out, you know, doing something in the yard or something. And after a while, he'd say, well, that's good enough for government work, you know. and that would be our saying, which just suggested, no, there's no real reason to do it really right if there's no real accountability except some general sense of the common good. And I think that's the doubt that that people have. No matter what great things the government does, there's a suspicion that because it's being done for a generalized good rather than a personal good, it can't be as good.
Do you think this completely undermines taxes to the point where nobody wants to pay them, or they don't want to pay streets in neighborhoods they never go to or things like that?
Well, you know, I think Ed really put his finger on it in talking about a national larger purpose that we can all agree on. I think it cuts two ways, because what we have done in the modern period is given everybody a stake in society. It's our government. It's our country. And the way we think about it in popular terms is it's my property. Therefore, I am a stakeholder in America Incorporated, and the government is responsible to me. The upside of that is when the government can make a plausible case to us, or any government can, that a compelling need exists, we'll rush to do it. I think that's the American story. But then there's this corrosive doubt that maybe our funds are being misused. And no matter where you think property comes from in the first place, and we could argue about that philosophically, it is a good and powerful question to ask. Where is it going? What's it being used for? And that Americans ask this question is not a bad thing, but if they ask it obsessively and it becomes the only thing on their minds, of course, it can be really corrosive and subversive.
Well, isn't that sort of related to that? Oh, it's the old Roman saw, who watches the watchers?
Right. Or who listens to backstory?
We're more into listeners than watchers.
And Brenda, call again.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. If drive a car, I'll tax the streets. If you try to sit, I'll tax your seat. And if it gets too cool, I'll tax the heat. Then if you take a walk, I'll tax your feet. Tax me!
So, Brian, we've managed to get almost all the way through our show about the history of American taxation without talking much about the most significant increase in taxation in all of our centuries. Isn't that right?
Yeah, you're right again, Ed. I mean, we did talk, in fairness, about the inception of the income tax in 1913. But the fact is, virtually nobody paid that income tax. It was a tax on a sliver of the population, literally millionaires. Most Americans didn't really start paying a lot of income tax until World War II. And two things happened during World War II. The number of Americans paying income tax went from 4 million to 40 million, in fact, more than 40 million during World War II. But the second thing that happened kind of reminds me of what we were talking about earlier in the show. A certain amount of invisibility was introduced to the income tax because they start taking money right out of people's paychecks
withholding.
To pay the taxes. Uh-huh. So you don't notice it as much. Mm-hmm. But people don't mind because people can see where their money is going. They feel they're getting their money's worth for those taxes. There's really no blowback from this. There's no pushback.
But surely that didn't continue after World War II ended, Brian. I mean, what happened when the Nazis and the Japanese no longer need to be fought?
Ed, this proves why you're such a brilliant 19th century historian.
Ooh.
In fact, it did continue because we had another war, although it was a different kind of war, as you well know.
It's like a trick question.
Yeah, exactly. No, that we had the Cold War. Mm. And Americans were happy to keep paying taxes because it was literally their federal government that provided the military, that built more atomic bombs and then more hydrogen bombs. They really had a sense of what their money was going for. And the economy was growing because more people were moving into the middle class. Mm-hmm. So it really underscores that the economic conditions are really crucial to understanding when Americans will willingly pay taxes, actually kind of forget about them, and when we have these flare-ups of tax revolts. Mm-hmm. So in my period, I think of Proposition 13, the California referendum that slashed property taxes in the late 1970s. I think of the Reagan Revolution, which slashed marginal tax rates and the income tax. These were very tough economic times for the United States.
And what that meant for taxes was people became very conscious, very aware of how much they were paying in taxes at the very time that the government didn't seem to be doing its job as we understood it in the 20th century, which was job number one is to maintain a healthy economy.
Yeah. Well, Brian, could you say in a way that anti-tax people beginning in the 70s, Proposition 13 and so forth, began to make the argument that the federal government particularly was making war against the American people? I mean, that same notion of war.
Yeah, but the new enemy is the government, which brings us back to where we started. It brings us back to those Southerners who were saying the government is extracting an unfair way.
It takes us back to the American Revolution itself, because that's the first great revolt against a distant, unresponsive government.
Terrific point. So if you were to start an anti-tax party today, you might want to name it the Tea Party.
You might indeed.
So this conversation is never going to end. And yet we feel that we discover it over and over again, that we're really the first generation to resist this idea of the rapidly growing federal government. Things are out of control. But in many ways, this is the American conversation from the time that the nation was founded to today. What is the proper limits and bounds of the government and its involvement in our lives? What do we owe each other through the medium of the government? And I don't know if other countries have a more peaceful history of all this, but certainly it is a bright red thread running throughout American history from the very beginning to today.
Keep on smiling, pay your taxes, do it now today. Then be thankful you are living in the USA. Bless this country with her justice and her liberty. Keep on smiling, pay your taxes, help to keep her free.
Sadly, that's all the time we have for today's show. But as always, we'll be waiting for you online to continue the conversation. Drop by and pay us a visit at backstoryradio.org.
And while you're there, sign up for our podcast. In the next few weeks, we'll be posting a special podcast-only edition of Backstory that focuses in on the Tea Party movement and asks what history can tell us about that movement's prospects for the future.
Again, we're at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field with assistance from Catherine Moore, Eric Verkirky, and Lydia Wilson. Jamal Milner mastered the show. Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Keep on smiling, pay your taxes for democracy.
Major support for Backstory comes from the University of Richmond, offering a combination of the liberal arts with law, business, leadership studies, and continuing education. More information is available at richmond.edu.
Support also comes from the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J.M. Weinberg, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is a Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.